You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin horse trainer tells us about a unique auction of wild horses and burros here in the state. First, June is Invasive Species Action Month here in Wisconsin. In a new report, the State Department of Natural Resources is highlighting both successful management efforts and some of the challenges that still remain when it comes to invasive plants and animals. They're also highlighting the role that you can play in reducing the spread of invasives. Tara Bergeson joins us now. She's a conservation biologist and the invasive species team leader at the Wisconsin DNR. Tara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
As we mentioned, Tara, it's Invasive Species Action Month here in Wisconsin. What's the goal behind this month?
Well, Invasive Species Action Month in Wisconsin is a great time to raise awareness about invasive species, the problems associated with them, which can range from harm to the environment and native species, economic impacts, and even harm to human health. And it's also a great time to encourage folks to take action and do what they can to protect our lands and waters from these harmful invaders.
A lot of times I think of it as a losing battle against invasive species, but your new report highlights some wins, at least at the local level. What are some of the successes you see out there?
That's right. There are some successes. So one example is a species called yellow floating heart, and this is an aquatic species. It had been found in Lake Gordon and was then not detected in 2018. So when we have species that we're concerned about, we do follow-up monitoring and try to go out and look and take control actions, and then we go back again and see if the species are still there. And so in 2018, surveys back in the area where the species was found did not turn up any yellow floating heart. So that's great news, but it also, you know, we still have our eyes and ears open, and we ask the public to be on the lookout for some of these species as well.
The report also mentions this nasty customer, this plant, giant hogweed. What's the story with that?
Yeah, so giant hogweed is a nasty plant. There are a number of known locations of this plant in Wisconsin. There may be some that we don't know about. And so, again, this is one where right now we're asking for help from the citizens of Wisconsin to keep their eyes open and to submit any reports of this species to us. But while giant hogweed can cause significant burns on the body. And so it's a good example of a plant that can actually cause harm to human health. It can be found along roadsides, and if you come into contact with it in combination with being exposed to sunlight, you can get a serious burn on your skin. The sap, if it gets in your eyes, can also cause problems. And so we like to let people know about this plant and make them aware, and if they're in an area where it might be, encourage them to, protect themselves, cover their bodies well, long pants, tucking socks, tucking your pants into socks, things like that. And then if you do get into contact with this plant, you want to thoroughly wash the area with soap and cold water as soon as you can, and then stay away from sunlight for 48 hours after that.
We're talking about invasive species in Wisconsin with Tara Bergeson, conservation biologist at the state DNR. Tara, if people are listening and they're thinking, yeah, I want to help spot and report invasive species or help prevent the spread, help eradicate, what can they do to find out how they can help?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like I said, we rely on help from lots of partners, including citizens around the state, to help us be on the lookout for these things, because we don't have the capacity here to do all that work ourselves. And so if someone's interested in helping out, there are a number of things they can do. If they go to the DNR's main webpage and search invasive species, there are a bunch of resources there, including a reporting forms and instructions on how to report. But I can also just say right now that if someone sees a species they think is invasive and want to report it, they can send information, including photos. Photos are really helpful so that we can verify species, a location, and contact information for the observer to invasive.species@wisconsin.gov.
Reading the report, it looks like, okay, it can be hard to manage and eradicate invasive species once they are in place. Let's talk about prevention some. What kind of things are there that we, whether we're talking about the DNR or Wisconsin citizens, can do to stop these things from spreading in the first place?
Yeah, that's another great question and really, really important. There's actually, along with talking about prevention, I also want to bring up early detection, which those two things in tandem are really, really important and can go a long way. And they're also things that anyone can do. So it's not just, you know, not just professionals who can work on early detection and prevention. So early detection is important because when we identify new species populations early, if they're just getting into the state and they're not well established, we still have a chance to take care of them before they spread too much. So we ask citizens to report locations of these species to us so that we can get out there quickly. Prevention is really, really important. Stopping a species from becoming established and widespread means that we save money, not having to do extensive control and management down the road. And Wisconsin actually has an invasive species rule, which not all states do. And the rule includes preventive measures, which is really important. And those preventive measures are not species specific, but they focus on addressing common pathways. So how do these invasive species typically move into Wisconsin and get spread around? And so examples of preventive measures are things like removing aquatic plants and animals, draining water from your vehicles and boats, trailers, equipment, when you're taking them out of the water so that you're not transferring things from lake to lake. It also might include cleaning your boots after you've been hiking in an area infested with an invasive species. If you're a hunter and you hunt with a dog, imagine, you know, seeds and things that might be become attached to your dog's coat. So cleaning your dog's coat after you've been out hunting with them. These are all really important preventive measures, and they're things that that everyone can do.
We'll leave it there for now. Tara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Tara Bergeson is a conservation biologist and the invasive species team leader at the Wisconsin DNR. She joined us to talk about the state of invasives here in Wisconsin and how you can help stop the spread of harmful plants and animals. Coming up, how'd you like your own wild horse? You'll have your chance to adopt one later this week, but know some ground rules before you do it. We'll find out why. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest talks about his love for wild horses, and we'll talk about how you can bring home one of your own before the week is over and what you need to know before you adopt a horse. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story for Father's Day.
Learning to ride a bike can be a milestone in a person's life. Lately, WPR producer and local dad, Brad Kohlberg, has been thinking about when he first learned how to ride a bike, teaching his daughter to ride, and what biking has meant to his family over the years, all because of a song he recently heard.
There's a band that I've followed on and off since college called Pedro the Lion, and they released a new song a while back called Yellow Bike. It's about getting your first bike and how the world opens up when you learn to ride it. It was a blast of nostalgia for me. It made me think of my first bike, my dad helping me learn to ride, me helping my daughter, and how important bike rides have been for my family over the years.
On a desert Christmas morning, 1981.
I got my first bike on my 6th birthday, a red Murray brand with chrome handlebars and chunky black tires. A bike for popping wheelies and doing sweet jumps. I loved it. The other neighborhood kids rode their bikes around in a little pack all day, and I really wanted to join, but I was embarrassed of the training wheels. So I begged, and my dad took them off, and I ran around pushing my bike beside me, trying to keep up with them. I couldn't. During practice sessions, my dad ran alongside me, gave me a nudge and let go of the seat. I'd coast, try to pedal, crash into the neighbor's mailbox. I even ran over my little brother one day when he wandered into my path and I couldn't steer around him. Sorry, Dave.
But I remember what it was like.
A friend had a bike that was smaller than mine, and my feet could easily touch the ground when I sat on it, which made it easier to coast. I'd ease down my driveway on his bike with my feet dangling to see how far I could go. One afternoon, I put my feet up and started pedaling, and I took off. I was riding. I still feel a little sad that my dad was at work when it finally happened. Sorry, Dad. But I didn't look back. The neighborhood became infinite. A motocross track, a battlefield, a movie set. All the money I made at my first job picking sweet corn went to building better bikes for bigger jumps. And I spent every summer day riding around town with my friends until I got to high school, when it became kid stuff, like overnight. My BMX gathered dust and was forgotten. Fast forward 25 years, and I was running beside my daughter in the church parking lot up the street as she learned to ride her first bike.
Okay, you ready? One, two, three. Go, go, go!
I gave her a nudge, let go of the seat, and watched her pull away from me and turn the corner out of sight. Now she's almost 14, and my old bag of tricks doesn't really work anymore. Legos, backyard baseball, trips to the playground. But she still rides around the neighborhood with me after dinner. We talk a lot while we ride, and sometimes we keep the conversation going with some ice cream afterward. It's the greatest. So when I heard that Pedro the Lion song, you know what I did? I went out and got myself a new BMX bike, a bike for popping wheelies and doing sweet jumps. Because sometimes dads and kids aren't that different, and I feel like a kid when I ride it, with my daughter beside me. It's the greatest. I trade my kingdom for
Brad Kohlberg is a producer for WPR in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, when you were a kid, did you ever dream about having your own horse? How about a wild, untamed horse? You could make that dream a reality this week. The Bureau of Land Management is holding an adoption event for wild horses and burros at the Central Wisconsin State Fairgrounds in Marshfield. You can show up, pick your horse, and even get some guidance on how to train it. But there are some really important details about horse ownership you definitely want to consider first. TJ Claiborne is a horse trainer originally from Australia. He now lives in Deerfield, just east of Madison, and specializes in taming wild Mustangs. He's going to be on hand to provide training for this week's adoption event. TJ, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, you've been a fan of horses, as I understand it, your whole life. What is it about horses that just captivated you?
Man, they're just wonderful animals. They're majestic, you know, God's own horse. You know, God said he was coming back on a wild horse, on a white horse anyway.
Can you remember your first experience actually riding a horse? A
little pony called Trixie.
Yeah?
Yeah. And my granddad got me a little pony, and that morning they left, and they took the back seat out of the car. I didn't know they were doing this. And when they came home, they took me out and opened the car door, and there was a little pony in there. So she was on the back seat. She was a Shetland pony. Her name was Trixie.
Huh. Now, it's one thing to ride on a tamed horse, right, that somebody's done the work on. Here we're talking about this adoption event. This is for wild horses that maybe have never had somebody ride them before. Whole different story, right?
Whole different story. These horses have never been touched. And I like them this way because they've never been domesticated. Domesticated horses are like human being traits. They've picked them up over time. They'll bite and scratch or kick, you know, that sort of thing. But wild horses, once they trust you, you've got them for life.
I got to ask, before we get more into wild horses, how does an Australian horse trainer end up here in Wisconsin?
Well, long story. Long story. No, I came over here to train horses in California for a friend out there, and I just had so many people. I went back to Australia in 1990, and I've been over here about 6 months, and they said, would you come back? And I said, yeah, righto, I'll come back, give it a go, you know. Been here ever since.
And I think people think of horses, they think Kentucky and places like that. We've got a pretty strong horse culture here in Wisconsin that I think for the rest of the country is under the radar.
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. The horse industry, in the whole industry in America, is a $122 billion industry. That's a lot of money into this economy. There's a lot of trails in Wisconsin that people can ride on. There's a lot of shows here in Wisconsin. And we've also had several Mustang challenges here at the Midwest Horse Fair.
Talking to TJ Cliborn, he's a horse trainer here in Wisconsin. There's an event, an adoption event by the Bureau of Land Management for wild Mustangs and burros. And you're going to be giving people some training who adopt these horses. Tell us about the story of these horses. Why are they being adopted? Why are they in Wisconsin?
Well, there's probably 50 to 60,000 horses in holding pens throughout the United States. They're usually out west. They're holding facilities. These horses are gathered in from the wild because there's not enough feed out there or number of reasons. They're gathered in. Then they go up for adoption for people to buy. And you have to be approved to adopt these animals. In other words, you have to have 6-foot-high fences, an enclosure to put these animals in. And somebody that really knows what they're doing to train these animals for you if you don't.
Yeah, talk about the right candidate, the right human to match up with these horses.
Oh, my, that's hard to say. I've had so many different people over the years adopt these horses, and some people have never even touched them before, never touched a horse.
Really?
But they think they're doing this great service by adopting a wild horse. So we try to get as many adopted as we can, and I try to help as many people as I can to adopt them. You know, so I'll go up there this weekend, and I'll take my own Mustang with me. Her name is Choke. She was my candidate for the 2009 Midwest Horse Fair Mustang Challenge. She got the name Choke because she ate the shavings pellets in a store when we got home that night. And she tried to die on me. Ooh. So I saved her life that night. And I told her if she was still alive in the morning, she'd have a home for life. And she's been with me ever since.
And won a Choke on Horse of the Year, I think, by the Wisconsin Horse Council.
Yes,
Choke is a celebrity
year.
Now.
Oh, yeah. She's got her own Facebook page and everything. She's pretty much a celebrity. And she's been everywhere with me. We've done, she's been to church. She's been to hospitals. She's been to functions for kids. She's been to school. She's rung the bell for the Salvation Army. Huh. So she does a lot of things.
Wild Mustangs, do they each have their own personality?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Every horse has its own personality. You know, some can be wilder than others. Some you can lay a hand on and they'll just be quiet as anything. You know, it's funny. You don't know until you get them how good they're going to be. I got one last year that was climbed up the back wall, you know, the first 2 weeks I had her. But she eventually ironed herself out, and she came around to my way of thinking, and we got along fine.
Now, I imagine somebody who's never owned a horse before, it would be a lot to jump in this week and adopt one, a wild Mustang, without that kind of background. But if somebody thinks, okay, yeah, this is something maybe I want to do in the future, How do they start to take the steps to get to know horses and get to know if they're the right person for the job?
Well, they can find somebody that's got horses and come out. I often have people come to my place in Deerfield and they can play with a horse and interact with the horses around the farm. Or they can find a trainer in their own area and go and look at horses and be around horses. With the adoption part of it, there's strict rules that they got to follow with the BLM. So even if they adopt this horse, they don't get ownership to that horse for a year.
They have to foster for a year.
Yeah, they have to foster for a year. So it's a big ordeal. And they have to have water and shelter and food. And people don't realize there's an expense that goes along with these horses.
Now, we've talked a couple times on the show, people bouncing back from trauma, working with horses in particular, and finding it this amazing therapeutic thing. What do we get as humans from working with horses?
Oh, It's just amazing that I get a warmth in my heart from working with horses. You know, they're just amazing creatures, you know, and for them to accept us is another big thing, because we are hunters, they are prey animals. So for them to accept us, it's a big ordeal. But once they do, oh, they're just the ultimate. They're just the ultimate. People like dogs. I like horses, you know.
Well, and from Trixie to Choke, I bet you've met a lot of great horses. I'm sure you could share stories for hours about the horses you've known.
Over 6,000 head of horses I've trained.
Wow.
In my lifetime. There was a man called Ray Hunt in this country who did 13,000. You know, I'll never ever catch him, but... I just try to help as many horses as I can find a good start in their life. To give them a good start is the best thing, because then they can go on and do anything, you know. I leave next week for New York, where I'll be doing 25 show jumping horses, well bred. You know, these horses are multi-million-dollar horses. And here I'm this weekend playing with $125 horses, you know. But I think these horses are worth just as much.
Yeah, well, give a pep talk to people to think about maybe taking the plunge, maybe not this week, but maybe in the future, to interacting with wild Mustangs and seeing if it's right for them.
Well, if you want to go to a Mustang, I believe that these horses will win you heart. You'll fall in love with them. There's no doubt about it. I've got several at home that are just... amazing animals. You know, they're just amazing. And people should come out if they got a chance this weekend and just have a look at
these
animals.
Just to see the auction?
Just to see it.
I mean, not
the
adoption
process. Just to see how
this
adoption works, and just to look at these horses, you know, and see if they're right for that type of deal.
TJ, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for coming up to the studio.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
TJ Claiborne, a horse trainer from Deerfield who specializes in working with wild Mustangs. He'll be in Marshfield for the Federal Bureau of Land Management's Wild Horse and Burro Adoption Event. That's this Friday and Saturday. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, opioid drugs get a lot of attention, but many Wisconsin communities are also dealing with meth addictions. Get the latest tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, you may have seen it happen. You've got people on two sides of an issue. At the beginning of a conversation or meeting, nobody feels too strongly. But once everybody picks a side, they dig in further and further. After a while, it looks like there's no way to bridge the divide. It can happen at a work meeting or in a local government hearing. It can happen in national politics or international relations. Our next guest says it doesn't have to be that way. With some ground rules and maybe some food, we can have productive conversations about divisive issues. Richard Kite is a professor and director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Rick, it seems like often in politics or in meetings or whatever, we end up with people talking past each other, and that can harden divisions and make it hard to arrive at any kind of compromise. Is that something you see happening often?
I see it happening every day. I see it happening in homes, in family arguments, see it at the workplace, and certainly see it in politics today.
And you've worked with small groups and organizations on doing things like setting ground rules to avoid talking past each other. What kind of things do you recommend people do?
Well, you know, it's not so much ground rules as just an awareness of the different ways in which we engage in moral reasoning. Because if we're more aware of how we think ourselves and then how we express those thoughts and how others do it too, then we can be attuned to talking to each other in ways that are actually productive instead of counterproductive. So I created something that I call the four-way method for ethical decision-making that just kind of highlights the ways in which we whenever we try to convince somebody that a certain action would be good or right or bad or wrong, what we do is we kind of zero in on one of usually four ways of thinking: truth, consequences, fairness, or character. And once we do that, if we're not attuned to how others are also talking about it, we can actually end up making the situation worse instead of better. And this isn't a matter of being uncivil or really being irrational or anything like that. It's just something that we fall into out of habit.
So if I'm arguing along the lines of fairness and you are arguing along the lines of consequences, we may both think we're totally right and wonder what the heck the other guy's talking about, right?
Well, yeah, and because what we do, and this is just part of the way our brains work, we focus on, first of all, the fact that what our solution is, and then the fact that the other person has a different solution. So if say I'm arguing about consequences, you're arguing using fairness, what I notice is that you disagree with me, also that you're not, in your reasons that you're advancing for your argument, you're not using any reasons that line up with mine. And so it's as if you're not listening to me and not responding to the good things that I'm talking about. And so my mind quickly jumps to thinking that you're being irrational or stubborn, whereas actually neither one of us is being very helpful to the other one in trying to find a common solution.
On a practical level, how do we sort that out? Say we're at a public meeting of some sort. How do we try to get us all at least arguing on the same page at the same time?
Well, it's something like a public meeting. What's important is, say, to have everybody use one kind of reasoning at the same time. And what I suggest is that everybody begins with truth and just say, look, we're not going to try to convince anybody else of what we should do based on, you know, the pros and cons or the process or people's motivations. We're not going to even go there. We're just going to talk about what are the facts. What happened? What is the situation? So that everybody's on the same page. And it is really remarkable how quickly people want to jump beyond. And once they've had assessed a few of the facts, how quickly they want to jump behind into some other kind of reasoning. And the more you can delay that, the more you can kind of establish a common understanding of what the problem is. And then you can say, once you've kind of discussed that, you can say, okay, now let's move on to consider the consequences. Who's affected? How are they affected in good or bad ways? And that is all future-oriented reasoning. So all the truth is really finding out what's the situation right now. Consequences is focused on what will happen in the future if we do plan A or plan B or plan C. And so you can get everybody focused in that way. And then what I recommend is once you've done that, go on to fairness, which is a matter of your process. That's how we're doing things. Is everybody being included? Does everybody have a voice? Are people being treated the way you would want to be treated? And then finally move on to character, which is people's motivations and why they're acting the way they are, why they're interested in certain solution rather than others and so forth.
Talking to Richard.
What it does is it lets us take advantage of our best selves rather than trying to manipulate or force our will into the discussion.
Richard Kite is with us from Viterbo University talking about how to have productive conversations about issues that can divide us. Rick, I was out in La Crosse for a listener event. I was talking to you about these things during the day, and you talked about observing that, at least in in-person gatherings like this, food can help really bridge gaps. What have you seen?
Well, I've just seen in all kinds of situations, if you can get people to actually sit down over a meal, we tend to relax. We tend to take on our guard. It takes us out of our kind of oppositional mindset. And the other thing is we get to know each other a little bit better. And once we know each other and find out that we can sit around in a setting like that, I think it operates subconsciously for us to be a little more open-minded to the possible good motivations behind somebody else's position. And so I've seen it work in kind of strategic planning meetings. I've seen it work in kind of contentious groups that are trying to forge long-time solutions involving, you know, taxpayer dollars and criminal justice issues and things like that. I've seen it in a variety of settings.
Now, on a bigger scale, do you have thoughts on how we in the media can create more constructive opportunities for people to participate in issues, especially during, say, a tough election season?
Well, that's really tough, because one of the things that happens is that once any of us have declared a position on something, we tend to lock into a favored kind of reasoning for it, and we tend not to be very open to going back and reconsider other ways of thinking about it. But I think that's something that those of you who are in the media could help us do a little bit better is by paying attention to the ways the arguments are being advanced, and then drawing attention to that. And this is not just advancing the argument itself. This is thinking about how we're thinking about it. So it's a lot of work. It's a lot to ask. But this is where I find things break down frequently, is that we don't pay attention to the ways in which we're thinking.
Rick Kite is with us from Viterbo University. He's giving some advice on how to have more productive conversations about issues that divide us in a small group or in a national or even international setting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this in, say, a meeting? People dig in on each side and they can't compromise? Or have you seen things work better than that? What made it work to you? Do you have solutions here? Do you see ideas here for our divided and divisive national politics? Or do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how to have better conversations when it comes to the issues that can divide us. Rick Kite is with us, professor and director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you participated in meetings or conversations that went south fast? Everybody picked their side and started talking past each other? Or have you seen things work better? What made it work better? What thoughts do you have on how we can talk in productive ways about issues that can otherwise tear us apart? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Rick, I want to take you into one of the toughest places these days, it seems like, to have a civil and productive conversation: social media. It seems to bring out the worst in a lot of us. Do you have advice for people on how to make better connections, better conversations when people aren't there in the room with us?
Well, one of the main things is that even on social media, you can ask sincere questions. And so instead of assuming the worst of another person in their argument, and then making charges against them, or just try to understand what they're saying and ask for a fuller explanation. Social media, of course, is one of these formats where we don't really engage in lengthy discussions. But it seems to me there's no reason why we couldn't use it that way. And we probably should, and then just avoid the short, one-line comments and comebacks.
Let's bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess when I hear about, our divisiveness, especially in the political arena, I kind of attribute it to the mainstream news media and how it's become much more polarizing. And I'll give you the example. A lot of people are ignoring the fact that under President Trump, the economy is doing so well. If they would at least talk about how improved our economy is and the growth of the country is, when they then comment on what really a lousy person he is, people would be able to say, well, at least they're trying to go both sides. By focusing only on what a lousy person he is, that really nobody disagrees with, the real thing, people aren't defending the fact that policies that are improving economic growth in the United States are also being addressed.
Charlie, thanks for the call. So Charlie says he's looking for more balanced or nuanced information from the media in this case, Rick.
Yeah, well, you know, you're in a tough position in the media because people say what they would like you to do, but then you're also, you're getting instant feedback on what people are actually responding to. And this is a relatively new thing. You know, before digital news, you didn't know how many clicks people were making on any certain story, for example. And so this is something that's a problem for us who are the news media consumers, is that we tend to give pretty instantaneous feedback about things. And we really, I'm sad to say, tend not to really like the balanced stuff. I mean, that's on us.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. We'll go now to Ross with us in Milwaukee. Ross, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Ross?
You know, my biggest thing is I feel that people just don't know how to have a conversation anymore. I think the problem starts is that everyone is trying to make everyone else feel stupid. Instead of having, you know, an open discourse and a conversation with someone, even if you have two different points of view, whether it's political or otherwise, everyone always wants to get that gotcha moment and make someone feel ignorant. And I feel like that is really stopping us as a society from, you know, growing and educating each other.
Ross, thanks for the call. Rick, what do you think of what Ross had to say?
I think it, in many ways he's absolutely right. And I think the most interesting studies that have been done on this are probably going back to Robert Putnam, his book Bowling Alone, I think was published in 1999, looking at the decline in civic engagement in the five decades from 1950 to about 1999. And as you have declines in civic engagement, what you have is people spending less time in actual conversations face-to-face with their neighbors and with strangers and acquaintances in communities. And what that does, all that practice and having those conversations face-to-face, is it makes you more understanding and more tolerant and more civil. And as we have less time doing that, but more time talking to strangers on social media, we tend to become less patient and we don't give a charitable interpretation to others' views.
Ross, thanks for that call. Rick, you've worked with a lot of groups. You've done trainings. Do you feel like there's a hunger for this kind of better, more civil, more productive conversation out there?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really amazing. People really want to have better conversations. They want to learn how to listen better, how to talk better in a way that is persuasive and not just critical. And I find it in groups. I find this really interesting. I find it among parents in wanting to know how can they have better conversations with their children so they aren't engaged in arguments over everything, but instead of some real discussions about what would be the best decision for them to make. And I find parents are really challenged in their discussions with their kind of middle school and high school age kids and are looking for help with that as well.
Rick, in our last minute, can you leave people with advice if they want to help lead the way toward these better conversations, more productive arguments over issues, local, personal, whatever? What's that one piece of advice you'd give them?
Ask sincere questions and start with the truth.
That simple?
That simple.
We'll leave it there for now. Rick, thank you so much for joining us today. Good to talk to you.
Okay. Good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
That's Richard Kite, professor and director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University. He joined us with some ideas on how to have productive conversations about divisive issues. If you have a story about this, positive or negative, we'd love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. What works, what doesn't work for you when it comes to having civil, productive conversations, even on issues that you might disagree with the other person about? Tweet us @CentralTimeWPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Wisconsin is one of the states with the highest number of golf courses in the country. Areas like Dane County have so many golf courses, private country clubs, daily fee, municipal, that it's a highly competitive market. As Phoebe Petrovic reports, it's squeezing the municipal courses in Madison.
It's a Thursday afternoon, well before 5 p.m., and the parking lot at Monona Golf Course in Madison is full. And it's a bit surprising because the city's four municipal courses are struggling. I mentioned this to Brad Munn, who coaches youth around Madison through a program called The First Tee. He is giving me a tour on a golf cart.
This is what I don't get. They say that it's down, but you see this, right?
How many people do you think are out here today?
They're probably going to do over 250 rounds today.
Madison's municipal golf courses have lost money for the last decade.
We've had a lot of folks say, raise your prices. We've tried that. It fails miserably.
Eric Knapp is Madison's park superintendent. He says raising prices costs them customers, and now the city's golf courses are in financial crisis.
At the end of the day, I think the foundational problem in Dane County is an oversupply with a lack of demand.
So now city leaders are trying to figure out what to do, and they say they're considering every option, including closing courses. The problems here are not unique to Madison or to municipal golf. Across the country, Florida, Pennsylvania, Kansas, too many golf courses are competing for too few golfers. Every year since 2006, the number of golf course closures has exceeded the number of openings. Back in the 1980s, the National Golf Foundation claimed developers could build a course a day for 10 years and still not meet the demand for golf. Jeff Davis with the firm Fairway Advisors says the NGF eventually walked it back.
The genie was out of the bottle. Developers, all they heard and the mantra became was build a course a day. And they did it.
Between the late 80s and early 2000s, the number of golf courses in the U.S. jumped by 44%. But most of these new golf courses had a particular type of look, purpose, and builder.
Waterleaf Golf and River Club, a one-of-a-kind residential community.
Out in the suburbs, private developers made lush, rolling golf courses the central amenity of their high-end homes and hotels. Greg Nathan with the National Golf Foundation says the rise in courses might have encouraged a rise in players if the developers built accessible, affordable courses.
In many cases, disproportionately, I would say, what they really wanted to do was sell real estate.
Nathan says that nationwide, course closures reflect the market correcting itself. About 10% of golf courses in the U.S. have closed since 2006, compared to the 44% rise in that two-decade boom. Many areas don't have the players to sustain all those courses, so those that remain have to compete for customers on experience and price. This is a problem for all types of courses, public or private. But Eric Knapp says it has specific consequences for municipal courses like Madison's.
American golf, I think, has always had a stodgy, affluent, elite feel. Now, I know that's not our golfers.
Knapp says they serve women, people of color, people of low or moderate income, the young and old. And he worries if the municipal courses shut down, where will all these golfers go? But Knapp says he also worries about the rest of the community, people outside of the game who may feel unwelcome on the golf courses, even though they make up about 17% of the city's parkland.
And I don't think it's good or healthy for our society, for our city, to have a space where we have 750 acres that are viewed as for these other people. That's for golfers.
And Knapp says golfers can be anyone. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, facial recognition technology is getting used more and more. That's cameras. They see your face. They run it through algorithms. It knows who you are. They're getting used more and more at borders, at airports, at businesses, local governments, and beyond. And there's some pushback. We'll look at the spread of facial recognition technologies and why they have a lot of people worried, especially about the data it's leaving out there about us. It's time for summer projects. We'll ask you what's on your to-do list around your homestead and how much you plan to procrastinate along the way. Do you really plan to procrastinate? I don't know. And sometimes we think we're going to be happy once we finally get the job, the promotion, the diploma, the new house, and then it doesn't pan out the way we thought it would. It's the arrival fallacy. We'll find out more, and you can share your experiences. All that, plus a look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.